What does that take when somebody comes to you or you go to somebody and say, look, let's start a whole new publishing venture? I mean, how do you do it?
Well, it takes time. It's taken us close to 2 years of working on it and planning it. And the first thing, of course, was to try to get the money. And that was the most difficult because we wanted to do a not-for-profit publishing house, one that wasn't going to return what people now who are investing in media expect to get. In fact, that's the very reason why we started it. We felt that you couldn't publish the kind of books that needed to be published, that were serious books addressing the problems facing the country, and come up with a 10 or 15% return that the media conglomerates are expecting of their subsidiaries. So we decided to try and go to foundations and to universities and other sources of help who would be willing to let us set up without being shareholders, without actually owning us. And at first, people were sort of surprised at the idea, but then they came around to it. And we used the analogy, really, in broadcasting of PBS. We said that some 20 years or so ago, when they tried to set up PBS, the feeling was that the networks had really stopped doing the kind of public service broadcasting that they used to do. And the same thing had happened in publishing, and a similar alternative was necessary. You needed a new kind of structure.
You say we. Who is we?
Well, there were a whole bunch of us. There were some of my former colleagues. There were some people who joined us who liked the idea. There were a lot of people from the foundation world who were intrigued and gave us advice. By the end of the year, we had some 50 people working on various advisory committees, telling us what was needed in their fields, naming authors, naming subjects that they thought we should deal with. In addition, of course, with all the authors I'd worked with in the past, so that people like Studs Terkel, whose book will be our first book, were encouraging us and helping us from the very beginning. So we had the two sources. We had the authors who stayed with us, who we've worked with in the past, and who wanted to support us, in fact, subsidize us by letting us publish their books. And then we had a new group of people in education and art and museum world and so on, who were fascinated by what we were proposing.
Now, perhaps we ought to go backward a little bit and go back to the days at Pantheon, because in a way, this is almost an extension of Pantheon, isn't it?
Well, not really. It would be nice to think that one's life had complete continuity, but there was a real break, and we're trying something very different. I was for 28 years at Pantheon, and Pantheon was owned by Random House during all of that time. And under Bob Bernstein's leadership and that of Cerf, Bennett Cerf and Donald Clawford before, there was a commitment to publishing a whole range of books. Everyone knew that the place had to make money, but they also felt it was important to address the serious political and social issues that the country had to confront. That was part of a responsibility that a publisher had. With the change of management in 1990, Bernstein left and was replaced by people whose values were very different, who felt that, and have said so publicly, that you judged a publishing house primarily by the amount of money it made. And obviously, if you do that, you have to change enormously what you're publishing. And so, faced with the choice of really pretty much destroying what we built up for the past three decades, or leaving, eight of my colleagues, the editors, all the editors, and I decided to leave.
As I recall, there was a great deal of outrage, letters to the editor, and I think, wasn't there a little picketing, too?
Right, well, there was much more of a reaction than any of us dared expect. There were several hundred people who picketed outside the Random House building because they felt they were being attacked as well, authors for the most part, whose work had been dismissed by being told that Random House didn't believe in what was called welfare clients or charity cases, authors whose books didn't make the amount of money that they were supposed to make. And so they were, I think, affected in a way more than we were, because they were, in effect, being driven out of their business. We were simply being asked to change ours. And overseas as well, there was an enormous amount of attention because people saw that as emblematic of the danger that the media conglomerates could present. In the past, publishing had never been that profitable. It had been known as a profession for gentlemen in a joking way. But it never made that much money. And it made money by having the firms grow in value so that people didn't lose money by investing in publishing, far from it. But the annual return wasn't the same as if you were selling steel or a cereal or whatever. The conglomerates, because they had interest in various fields, changed that. They wanted to have the same profit in their newspaper holdings and the cable holdings and in publishing as such. And so they brought in a new kind of attitude towards publishing, a new kind of attitude towards books.
Of course, those of us who feel deeply about books, and not only the words contained therein, but the tactile feel of a book and the love and possession of a book, felt deeply about Pantheon, and the belief also that a book does not have to make money, but in actuality, in real terms, as we maintain our our households and as we pay our taxes and pay our bills and this sort of thing. Money is a factor. And certainly Random House, you would not expect Random House to operate without a profit.
No, certainly not.
And indeed, if Random House did not operate without a profit, there would have been no Pantheon.
Certainly, and there was no. It wasn't a question of how. You see, it wasn't a question of profit or no profit. That's where it gets more interesting. Random House always made a profit, and Random House increased in value when it was bought by Newhouse. He paid something like $60 million. 7 years later, it was worth $900 million. So you can count profit in that way too. It was worth quite a lot. Pantheon was worth about $500,000 when Random bought it. It could have been sold for close to $20 million when I left. So you're not exactly losing money by investing in publishing. You're not getting as much back on an annual basis. If you look at all of publishing for the whole country over the last decades, the average post-tax profit was 4%. That's not very much. But that was standard for all the publishing houses, whether they were very commercial or not so commercial. That was an average. Pantheon never lost money for Random House. And if one looked carefully at the books for those many years, you would see that what we had said we would do and what we did was to break even. And that was understood that other parts of Random House, the paperbacks and so on, made more money. The rest of the hardcover publishing made less. And it was the way you diversified your portfolio. It was a way that you made sure you had authors for the future. You took some risks on the hardcover books, and then you sold the successful ones in paperback for years to come. So it worked out very well. And the value of the firm, as I quoted, it shows that it was an operating company that had a very good setup. So it was really a question of how much would you want to do? Do you want to try and have every book maximize its profit? Do you want to cut out the books that lose money? And you can do that, but then you change the nature of the whole thing.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the authors Pantheon had under your stewardship and the authors that you have today. I would probably not be wrong in saying that the vast majority of Americans have not heard of your authors, with the possible exception of Studs Terkel.
Well, a lot of Americans are familiar with The Simpsons, and Matt Groening was somebody who we published for the first time. We published him after a lot of people didn't want to publish him. And the same is true of Art Spiegelman, who's got two volumes of Mouse, one of them now on the bestseller list.
That was certainly a brilliant decision on your part.
Well, it was part of what we were about. We took Mouse on after 13 different publishers turned it down.
Including Pantheon.
Including a young reader at Pantheon who didn't know what he was doing. But that one of the good things is to be able to catch your mistakes. So that there were areas there where the books were innovative and different and funny, as Greening's work certainly is, but still didn't seem to be commercial enough to fit into what most publishers at that point were looking for. And then there were other people, whether it's Foucault or Eugene Genovese or whatever, that people read in their history courses or in their sociology courses without necessarily thinking of the publisher. But a lot of the books that we publish, I think, helped to shape the way people think about
but
America.
Many of your authors had some international reputation.
Indeed.
As opposed to an American reputation.
Right, and then some like Gunnar Myrdal crossed the ocean and had both. But part of what we were doing, and you're raising an important point, we tried to introduce people who weren't that well known. That was the whole point of what Pantheon was about. It was trying to find authors who were saying something new and important that already weren't available on the market. You can run a publishing house by simply bidding more for a bestseller than anybody else, and that's increasingly what is happening, unfortunately, where whoever pays Nancy Reagan the most money gets to publish her book. But to find somebody completely different and completely new is a lot harder. And that's really what we set out to do. And that's, of course, why it was understood with Random House that we were simply going to break even, because if you do that, you're not going to make money immediately. And when we first published Matt Groening's books, nobody thought those would make a lot of money. I think Harper sold something like a million and a half of his books in the last year or so. So after a while, if you guess right, some of the time, it works out.
Well, it's obvious that you've felt very strongly about Pantheon. You said you were there for 28 years.
Right, right.
I mean, that's a whole career. I mean, some people retire after 28 years. But you felt strongly enough. Did you actually resign from Pantheon?
Yes, yes. No, I could.
You felt strongly enough that did they tell you there has to be a bottom line here?
It wasn't so much as a bottom line, because we felt we were actually going to make a lot of money the next year with Matt Groening's books. There was no question in my mind that we were going to be very profitable. I think that's been said since by the Random House people. We simply disagreed basically on what publishing was about. They felt that we should try to publish only the books that would make the most money and cut out the difficult and innovative ones. We felt that the Matt Greenings and the other books should help pay for the difficult books. And so there was a basic disagreement as to what you were trying to do. And they wanted to address that question early on in the new administration at Random House.
Well, before we get on to the new press, which is why we're here after covering the background, I think Fred Jordan is head of Pantheon, isn't he?
It's difficult to know who is head of Pantheon at this point because it's no longer an independent entity. Sonny Mehta of Knopf really runs it, and there are various people. There are several vice presidents under him, but I think he makes the decisions.
Of course, Jordan at Grove Press published many of the same kinds of books that you did.
He did, and I'm sure that's why he was brought in as a putative successor, but it's also why he, at this point, has not signed on many books.
Of course, probably a good move on Fred's part. I mean, Grove Weidenfeld was kind of a sinking ship.
It
started off with such a bang, and it had Thomas Berger and James Purdy, and had a whole bunch of people that started with them, a great literary list, but it, I guess, like Pantheon, it wasn't within the framework of a large enough organization to be able to sustain itself.
Well, ironically, when it was bought by Weidenfeld, their backlist was what was keeping that firm going, and the Pantheon backlist was doing very well also. So it's really a question of what have you done for us recently, and I think one has to look at books now. What are people publishing now? What do they represent? I think with the disappearance of the Pantheon that was, you see a whole kind of book no longer being available on the market. If you look at the election year coming this year and you look at the major issues, you know, I don't think there's a single book for the general reader on the health crisis, for instance, to take an example that suddenly is something everybody's discussing. Well, there ought to have been books discussing those issues and raising those questions so that people could have an informed debate during the election period. And I walked around the ABA last May, and I looked at the books that were coming out, and I was surprised. It was how little there was on the basic issues confronting society as a whole.
So, we come to the new press, which is already in trouble because I see the catalog was published backward.
Did you really? That's the only copy that I've seen with that.
It's upside down.
Oh, my God.
I'm getting off to a rocky start here.
I hope you have a rare first edition there, like an upside down stamp. I haven't seen that before.
In laying the groundwork for the new press, I guess it was a lot of going around hat in hand, I guess, approaching foundation. How do you do it? Draw up proposals or what?
Well, it was really saying, and giving an analysis of what was going on and saying there are a lot of things no longer available, as I just said, in publishing and in the way people decide what's going to be available to the general reader. You have university presses that are very valuable, but the average sale of an average university press book these days is 600 copies, which means you're not even reaching the public libraries, much less the individual reader. And that's a serious and bad situation, which ought to be remedied. But that means the university presses, for the most part, can't reach the general audience. So we made the argument that I was referring to before, that there ought to be, there isn't in theater, for instance. You used to have, a few years ago, there were no not-for-profit theaters. There are now hundreds and hundreds. There used to be no not-for-profit television. There is now the whole PBS network. The same thing has happened in magazines, where Harper and Ms. have now shifted to a not-for-profit status, which means that they can publish things that the others can't because they're not under the same profit pressure. And we both made the argument in general for a new structure, which is what I think mattered at most at this point, to have something that's going to be around for years, and then gave examples. We gave examples of the hundreds and hundreds of kinds of books that we could publish that nobody else was doing and that were really important. And I think people were gradually persuaded by that.
So eventually you began lining up commitments.
Right, right. And we have the first 2 years' worth of books more or less lined up already, even though we're just setting up. And we have literally hundreds more that we could do if we had the support and the time. We're not going to do more than 40 books a year at this point.
What is the major cost in forming a publishing company? Certainly not paying the authors.
Well, actually, it is paying.
Most authors that I have talked to, and I've done it for years and years, have complained bitterly about the the pay scales. So I guess there is no scale.
Right. No, it's how about the pay that authors
right.
receive. It's true that most people have figured out that authors aren't even paid the minimum wage if you look at the amount of time they spend. The trouble for publishers, and it is true for anyone, is that you're paying for something that's going to be available 2 or 3 years down the road. And it may take you 3 years before you get your money back, in any even if you lose part of it. So that if you give an author an advance today, it'll be 1995 before the book is sold in the bookstore. So you simply need the capital to invest in that. That's a major factor as far as planning is concerned. A lot of it, though, depends on how lavish a lifestyle you want to lead. And one of the things we wanted to do was show that you could publish in a not-for-profit without the excesses that many of the private firms now have, both in terms of salary, in terms of headquarters, in terms of money that's spent on a day-to-day basis. The University of the City of New York, CUNY, gave us some free space, which was extremely helpful in one of the CUNY office buildings in Midtown.
Is that where you work?
Where we're working now. And during our first year, we spent something like $50 on furnishing the offices and setting up shop. So it shows that you can do it on a shoestring if you want to, and you can spend the money that you do have on getting the books underway.
And, of course, in terms of staff, I noticed that you have Lynn Goldberg as the publicist rather than hiring a publicity staff of your own.
Right. We do have...
Farming it out, I guess.
Right. We're farming out a lot of work. Everybody is doing 2 or 3 jobs, and a lot of people have helped on a volunteer basis. As I said, we had some 50 people on various advisory committees doing what paid consultants or editors would normally be doing in a publishing house.
Are you and your staff being paid a livable wage?
Well...
Do this work?
Now we are. At the outset, we had a very small paid staff, and I worked without a salary for enough time to get this going. But we feel very strongly that neither the authors nor our lower paid staff should be paying the cost of the experiment. We should have enough money to pay them decently and to pay them what they would be paid elsewhere. But we've done very careful studies, and we think we can publish effectively and cover the expenses of publishing without, as I say, having to come up with a very heavy contribution to corporate overheads as we had to before, or the profit.
Of course, it should be stated that publishing as a whole is notoriously low paid. I believe Publishers Weekly had a recent survey of the publishing salaries, which are extremely low in comparison to most communications.
Yes, they're very low. They're very low. You have the extremes of the heads of the large houses and of the conglomerates. I mean, you see that Steve Ross has raised his salary from $75 million a year to $99.9 million. I guess he thought $100 million was excessive. You have to figure that some of the people at the very top are being paid a great deal. And I think that's true in the large conglomerates there. The salaries there are excessively high, as are the lifestyles. The ordinary folks who are working as first readers or editors or whatever are probably making roughly what they would make if they worked in universities, and so that kind of a scale, which is not very high.
But this is the higher level, the editors.
Right, or the assistant editors or whatever. It used to be that the scale was more or less parallel. An assistant editor was making what an assistant professor would have made and so on. It depends on the house.
John Baker was telling me an amusing story, which you probably have heard, but it dealt with a young woman who came to New York to work for a publishing firm who was having trouble making ends meet, so she went to her boss to say that she had to quit and find another job because she couldn't live on her salary. And her boss said, "Good God, you weren't trying to live on it, were you?"
Right. I think that's in a way that publishing got its initial reputation as a profession for gentlemen, because people had private incomes when they came in. And I think that's traditionally been the case. But again, as things change, as you get more and more big money people coming in, they have salary expectations which are based on their previous job, not on their next job.
I was reading an essay by Ambrose Bierce recently, and it dealt with pay scales and publishing and so forth, and it quoted Henry Holt of the 19th century, Henry Holt, who said that indeed publishing was a gentleman's field, and that authors should not expect to be paid or to make any money for it, because he wanted to eliminate the idea of crass commercialism within the publishing industry. Well, there's something to be said for that, and at the same time, people who love words and want to use words to communicate ideas and do it on a full-time basis need some sort of support. And if the commercial publishers can't do it, then it's going to be up to universities. And many of the authors that I have talked to over the years indeed work for universities, or as you're doing with the New Press, getting grants and funding in various ways. But somewhere along the line, it has to be done.
Right. No, I agree. And I think one of the difficulties is that publishing traditionally was supported in many ways, either by the government or by universities. Indirectly, there were lower postage rates for books. The library budgets, which were government budgets, paid for a lot of the books that were published. The universities had a lot of professors who were writers in residence, and they certainly assigned a lot of the books. So there was a whole structure of support, which was based on the fact that the publishers couldn't really make that much money themselves, and they deserved help from various other parts of the society. There was also an antitrust act that said you couldn't conglomerate all of the media together under one ownership, and if you had televisions and newspapers and so on, you weren't really supposed to own book publishing houses. In the last years, none of that, of course, has been observed, and part of what we're dealing with is really the effect of no longer enforcing the antitrust act.
Yeah, I think the term is called deregulation.
It's never been admitted in publishing. I mean, you've deregulated the airways, and a lot of them have gone bankrupt. But it's been benign neglect, I suppose. It was simply a decision not to rock the boat, and after all, the newspapers and the TV are important in giving political support to candidates, and it's the easy way out is not to harm them economically. But a lot of what we're talking about simply wouldn't have happened if the old Antitrust Act had been applied. And, of course, what happens is that the fewer houses you have, the fewer publishing houses you have, the fewer people working in publishing, the fewer books ultimately, because the decision is to cut back on the number of titles that aren't that profitable. And in PW the other day, there was the figure that the number of titles had gone down by 17% in the last couple of years. Now, that's an enormous number. I'm not saying that all the books that are published should be published, but if you cut down 17% of your output, a lot of that is going to be the so-called marginal book, the first novel, the more demanding kind of nonfiction and so on. That no one has studied that yet, but it would be interesting to see how the overall profile has changed from that cut.
Well, it used to be said that publishing was recession-proof. Is that true?
Right. Indeed, it used to be said that, and I think during the 30s that was indeed the case. I think as the structure of publishing has changed, the expectations have changed. So you've had the double pressures on publishing in the last few years. You've had the recession, which has had an effect, and then you've had the demand for increasing profitability at the same time. And that's been a squeeze play that has caused more and more people to go under. When you think of somebody like Jim Silberman's Summit being knocked out, and Simon & Schuster, that really tells you a great deal about how the thresholds have been raised, because those books were, in some part, serious and important books. A lot of them were commercial books, and I'm sure that the mix was making money. The question is, again, how much money? And so when you eliminate something like that, you can see it's not really the extremes that are being eliminated, but your 17% cut is going to affect what we think of as the old-fashioned, middle-of-the-road good book.
Well, let's go back to the New Press. You have come out with your new catalog and a brand new list. Tell me a little bit about the authors in this catalog and what the New Press's expectations are.
Right. Well, the first list is deliberately a small one. We just weren't able to get all the books out at the outset, and we also wanted to find our legs so that we could do the things in the right way. So we have about 10 books on the first list. We'll have about 15 on the second, and then we'll level off at about 20 books a list after that. We also wanted to use the first few books to show the range of things that we're going to do. So that the first book is Studs Terkel's new book on race, which will be out next April, and which is a book on what ordinary Americans, black and white, think about race, which has become, unfortunately, the major issue facing the country at this point. And the book is a fascinating, honest look at people who are much more polarized than they used to be. And you can see the changes that have taken place in the country since the 60s by listening to the voices of people who are not necessarily extremists, but who are people who find the distance between themselves and those of other races to be growing. So that's going to be a major and important book, I think, that's going to raise a lot of questions. We're going to do a lot of books in this area. One of the things we feel that's been neglected in last years have been books about the social problems, books about the needs of minorities, and we'll deal with them in different ways. We're doing a book of postcards from the Schomburg collection here in New York City, which is based on their photographic collection of black photographers over the last 100 years. Now, there's another example of the kind of book that hasn't been published in the past, partly because it's simply not been profitable enough, even though it'll cover its own costs. And we've looked at the 300,000 photographs in their archives, and we've made a small selection so that we have a paperback book that can be bought by the average Afro-American without making too deep a dent in his pocketbook, and which will give him a sense of a heritage he didn't know about. We're doing two books on censorship in the arts, again an issue that hasn't had much said about it, but the whole question of what's happened to freedom of expression since the Helms attacks on the NEA, since the museums were attacked for showing Mapplethorpe and so on. And we have two books on that, which are going to be, I think, very helpful in igniting that debate. I have a new book by Edward Thompson, the great English historian, called Customs in Common, on how societies changed during industrialization. We have in the fall Marguerite Duras's next novel, a sequel to The Lover. We have a range of things which go from the books that are admittedly very difficult and economically are going to barely break even to books that we hope will help pay for the others.
Duras looks as though it's the only fiction I can see right now.
Right, and we're not going to publish much fiction or poetry. We decided that there were a lot of very good small presses that were doing that extremely well, in addition to the good independent publishers who still maintain their old commitment to serious fiction. So I don't think it's a field there, in American fiction, where people can't get a good work published.
So your focus primarily is on major social issues.
Well, the intellectual...
Cultural and social,
right. And we will translate fiction from other cultures, because that, too, is something that's disappearing. Fewer and fewer people are willing to translate into English, either here or in England, where the same phenomenon has taken place. And we think that's important, that you get to know a lot about other cultures by seeing how people are dealing with them in their fiction. But as we say, that this is an area, we're trying to focus on the areas that are being neglected so we can add something new and different.
Now, the books are being distributed by Norton, is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. So you have a major distributor that most of the books will be in the major bookstore.
And most books,
presumably.
Right.
I understand that a lot of the chains determine how many books they're going to stock in there, and it may be difficult to break that kind of mythical barrier that prevents a lot of books from being stocked by Dalton and places like that.
Well, happily, many of the books that we're publishing are books that would traditionally be sold by independent publishers, and Norton has very good relations with all of those. And I think the chains are beginning to see that they need to stock more. They've begun these superstores and so on. They have begun to realize that not stocking a lot of books is simply a mistake, and I hope they'll continue to change their ways in that respect.
How do you determine what the size of a print run would be for an individual book?
Well, we do it the way all other publishers do, and that is to say we meet with our salespeople, in this case the Norton salespeople, look carefully at the books, look at what they think the stores will take, and print pretty much what the stores will buy.
Well, that's not the way Barney Rossett did it, or does it. Mm-hmm. I asked him that same question once, and he said...
Well, you do that in choosing the book, and then after that, you do it partly by presenting the book as attractively as possible. But there's some books that we are publishing knowing that the audience will be limited, and there's no sense printing twice as many as you're going to be able to put into the stores. We have a book, for instance, with the ACLU on AIDS and what to do with the social and commercial policies that affect AIDS, such as insurance and so on. It's a very important book. It's a book that they try to get published with all sorts of commercial and university presses for the last year and couldn't find any takers for it because nobody wanted to lose money publishing that book. So we're doing it, but we're doing it with a small printing because we know that the number of people who are professionally involved here is going to be limited. Doesn't mean that the book isn't going to have an influence or that people won't write about it or learn from it. But there's no sense printing 10,000 if you can only sell 3,000.
How many books did you say a year you plan to
publish? We will do, by 2 years from now, we'll get up to 40 books a year, and we're doing about 25 this first year.
Now, do you seek out authors, or do they seek you?
For the time being, because we hadn't gone public, we were seeking people out and talking both to authors and to institutions, to museums and social organizations and educational groups and the like. Now people will seek us out, and if anyone is hearing this, I hope they won't send us their manuscript, but will write us a letter first, because we can't handle all the flood of manuscripts that would come in otherwise. But if people want to write to us and suggest something, then they'll get a response.
Now, about your own background, you were at Pantheon for 28 years, so that's 30 years now, at least 30 years in publishing, and, maybe more. Had you had some expectation in your undergraduate days that you would go into the publishing industry?
Not really. My father was a publisher, and therefore I always assumed that I wouldn't go into publishing. You always hesitate to try and follow in your father's footsteps. And I thought, in fact, I would teach. But after being in graduate school for a few years, I realized that that was not the world for me. And I started out working for a mass market paperback publisher, New American Library, where I worked for 2-3 years, and which was marvelous preparation for what the real world of publishing is about.
You must have joined Pantheon fairly early then.
I was very young, yes. I was 26 when I first came.
How did you start there?
I started as an editor. It was just after the Random House takeover. And within the year that I'd arrived, the two people who had hired me had both decided to leave, and so I was left with my colleagues more or less running the show at what then seemed to me a reasonable age, but now that I look back on it, it seems also young.
28 years, that's extraordinary in an industry where there is such enormous turnover.
Well, we had the great advantage of being able to publish more or less what we wanted all those years. Random House's support was fantastic, and they believed in what we were doing, and I think we rewarded them with a list of distinguished and useful books. And that's, in a way, why leaving after all those years was so much easier, because you don't, as I say, want to stand around and undo everything you've done for the previous part of your life.
Well, your father being a publisher, you must have... Well, no wonder you got into the publishing business, although you said you initially had thought about teaching, but it must be wonderful growing up in a literary household, which is such a head start.
It's true. I mean, you grow up in an atmosphere where you're talking to authors all the time without realizing it a little bit, like in Molière speaking prose without realizing that's what you're doing, and it does rub off on you. But it's also, I think, having... You know, growing up not only reading a lot of books, but also thinking about the whole question of how do people discuss things in a society? How do they get new ideas? How do new thoughts come through? And in a way, publishing is the most personal of the mass media. It's still a place where two or three people can get together and say, this is an important idea, let's do something about it.
Well, that's certainly a fitting statement to conclude our talk. For those of us who love books, having a new publisher on the scene is extraordinary and a wonderful thing. Certainly wish you the well with the new press.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for talking to me.